Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show,
For example, coming from non-English speaking background, will be evaluated in certain ways, etc. Right? So,
a new study finds AI hiring systems are discriminating against job applicants.
I think Labor like to be able to ensure that they're going to allow those in that would ultimately support their policies, their views, and vote for them.
Senator Jacinta Price's migration comments spark backlash. And later today,
that other people with disabilities need. They also need the same types of services and supports that other refugees need.
A research is highlighting refugee disability challenges in Australia. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. An Australian First study has found that artificial intelligence hiring systems pose a significant risk of discrimination. This year, over 60% of Australian organisations used AI in job recruitment processes, according to the Responsible AI Index. However, research has shown that historically disadvantaged groups are being systematically screened out. The Wire's Sarah Jens has more.
AI hiring systems are now the norm in graduate recruitment, according to the 2025 Australian Human Resource Index. University student Fari Frisandi recently completed an AI video interview for a graduate position at one of the Big Four consulting firms. He says the experience left him with serious concerns.
Candidates are felt that AI is not being transparent in terms of like how they are being evaluated. I think that is one. Second, like there is a concerns about like, you know, this ethical thing, right? Like whether for example, coming from non-English speaking background will be evaluated in certain ways, etc. Right? So I think again, coming back to the point around like number one is transparency. Second is like how companies can make sure that they are actually mitigating the risks around bias and ethical risk. I think that's super important for the candidate.
Those concerns aren't unfounded. Research by Dr. Natalie Sheard has found that AI video interviews can discriminate against people whose first language is not English. Her study also found that previously protected characteristics, including gender, age, and disability status, can be purposely filtered out by employers using these systems. Given transparency issues around AI, Dr. Sheard says algorithm discrimination is hard to audit.
There is some evidence that some employers actually use these systems to weed out certain categories of people. So in a kind of intentional discrimination situation. And I guess you could say that these systems give them a license to discriminate because that discrimination, when these systems are used, is hidden. It's masked, it's cloaked, it's very hard for applicants to know that it's happening to them. You know, it's felt in different way, or it's not really felt in the same way that human discrimination might be felt by a job applicant.
Dr. Sheard's study also found that data sets used to train AI hiring systems do not reflect the Australian demographic. US-based tech company HireVue conducted over 1 million AI-screened interviews in Australia in 2022, but just 6% of HireVue's data comes from Australia and New Zealand, while nearly 80% comes from North America. Australia's First Nations people are entirely absent from HireVue's data set. Dr. Sheard says these systems are grounded on training data that discriminates.
Anyone who is unrepresented in the training data or who is experiencing present day or historical discrimination, which again is in the data that will be used to train the model, yet could experience discrimination.
Currently, job seekers must rely on general discrimination and privacy laws, which don't directly address AI. Dr. Sheard says companies using these systems need to understand the risks.
audits should be conducted of these systems before they are deployed, but there are certain problems even in doing that because we don't have the regulatory framework to conduct those audits. You know, we don't have accreditation processes for auditors. We don't even really have consensus about what are the appropriate thresholds. So I think there are a lot of kind of barriers for employers to ensuring that they are deploying a tool that doesn't discriminate.
Last month, the federal government announced a gap analysis to determine whether Australia needs AI-specific legislation. Human Rights Commissioner Ms. Lorraine Finlay says the government can't afford to wait.
I think the risks call for immediate action because, of course, we need to be using the current laws that we have and identifying the gaps that are there. But this is a conversation we've been having for a number of years already. The government last year proposed mandatory guardrails for high-risk AI, and we're conducting consultations. And the challenge with that is while those consultations are happening, the technology is continuing to move forward and real harm's actually being done to people.
The Productivity Commission has opposed AI legislation, warning it could limit an economic growth opportunity for Australia. But Ms. Finlay says efficiency shouldn't come at the expense of human rights.
Increasing efficiency in itself shouldn't be a goal if the increased efficiency comes at the expense of human rights and causes harm. Increased efficiency in diminishing human rights shouldn't be our goal. But secondly, we actually know that Australians have a relatively low level of trust in AI and emerging technologies. And so part of building the trust that then allows the public to embrace the technology and that then drives the productivity and efficiency gains that we want to see actually comes from having guardrails in place.
The government's analysis is expected to be completed by end of this year. But for graduates entering the job market, that timeline may feel too late.
Sarah Jens there with that report. A federal senator's remarks on Indian migrations have reignited debate over the politicalisation of immigration policy in Australia. Senator Jacinta Price claimed the Labor government was allowing in large numbers of Indian migrants because the community votes Labor, a comment that draws criticism from both community leaders and within her own party. While Price says her concerns is more about mass migration, critics argue her comments reflect a dangerous political framing of ethnic communities. I spoke with National Radio News political reporter Noah Saccone for more.
It is definitely the core number. And of course, there is a focus from this government to be getting them from particular countries over others. And
isn't it a non-discriminatory policy?
I think Labor like to be able to ensure that they're going to allow those in that would ultimately support their policies, their views, and vote for them as well. So
we just heard Jacinta Price talking about immigration on the ABC's afternoon briefing Wednesday last week. Noah, how damaging are her comments to the relationship between the Liberal Party and multicultural communities, particularly in electorates with large Indian populations?
Well, yeah, it's certainly been a bit of a surprise angle for the Liberal Party to take last week. There's a lot of talk saying that they'd kind of achieved a win off the back of the aged care changes, and then for this to happen, it's quite a distraction. So worth noting that these comments came just a few days after the March for Australia across the major capital cities, where we saw particularly violent scenes break out in Melbourne. And part of that was fueled by an anti-immigration policy and partially by neo-Nazi organisations as well. So it was quite a contentious event. So then to hear Jacinta Price speaking against migration and explicitly suggesting that Labor is picking and choosing who is immigrating to Australia to try and gain votes was quite an inflammatory move. And as you mentioned, she said that on Wednesday, and the day before the Home Affairs Minister, Tony Burke, confirmed that permanent migration figures remained at the same level that they have for the past few years at 185,000 a year. And so then to hear that the next day where Jacinda Price is saying this is too much, that it's, you know, it's mass migration, we don't have the infrastructure for it, this idea that we can't cope, essentially, which goes against a lot of what, you know, refugee groups and immigration advocates say when they're talking about, you know, a lot of our skilled workforce is sourced from overseas. So, yes, while she was specifically, while she was broadly talking about the government picking and choosing who comes to the country, she did go on to say in the same interview on Afternoon Briefing on the ABC who she thinks is being targeted by this push.
So who do you think they're trying to bring in to make them vote for Labor?
Well, those that are more Labor-leaning, that are likely to be...
But there are right-wing and left-wing people in every community, right? So who specifically are they?
Well, as we've seen, you know, you yourself mentioned that there is a concern with the Indian community, and only because there's been large numbers, and we can see that reflected in the way that the community votes for Labor at the same time. So if they're going to see a reflection that, okay, these individuals are going to vote for us more so than other parts of the community, well, then of course they're going to express a view that we'll get those sorts of individuals into our communities. And we've heard that
they would contest that, right? You would accept that. They would say it's a non-discriminatory policy that has nothing to do with making assumptions about how people will vote.
Well, what are the political, I guess, risks of framing immigration policy around voting behaviour?
Well, it's certainly a strong call, and a lot of Senator Price's Liberal colleagues have been quick to say that it's really not fair to stereotype an entire community, an entire group of Australians, saying that they all vote a specific way, one way or another, no matter who says it. So there's quite a lot of pushback from just that notion to begin with, that all Indian Australians vote for Labor or, you know, anything otherwise. So there's been a quick mopping up, I guess, from, you know, Susan Lee the next morning was on TV trying to say, this is not the position of the party. We'll never repeat these sort of sentiments again. That's not where we sit. And already we've heard a lot of commentary from within the Indian diaspora in Australia that, you know, they're quite horrified that this has been said on a national broadcaster. The Liberal Party has spent the last week essentially in damage control, trying to figure out how to navigate this, and we still haven't heard an explicit apology from Jacinta Price yet.
Yeah, I was just going to mention she did come on Sky News yesterday night saying that she's got a great relationship with the Indian members within her community, and added that mass migration is a huge concern. Will we see a formal apology soon?
I'd be surprised. I think if she's not going to willingly give that straight away. She's walked back and clarified some of the points, saying, yes, there is a non-discriminatory migration policy. And to assume otherwise is just completely wrong. But to actually outright apologise for saying that, we haven't seen that. And even from pressure from other MPs, we heard from the Prime Minister today saying that she should apologise as well. So there's a long list of people saying she should, but whether or not that actually would be, like, whether or not being told to apologise is going to encourage anyone to apologise, I don't really know.
NRN's political reporter Noah Saccombe speaking to The Wire. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Mameen Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. New figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics reveal a troubling rise in food insecurity, with 1 in 8 households unable to afford enough food. The rising cost of living means families are cutting back on fresh produce and protein, often turning to cheap processed foods just to get by. Senior lecturer in nutrition and dietetics from University of Wollongong, Dr. Catherine Kent, says the nutritional cost of food insecurity is driving long-term health issues and deepening inequality across generations.
Food insecurity is the situation that occurs when people just don't have enough money to put food on the table every day. And it can range from being worried about not having enough money for food to buying cheaper, poorer quality food because you can't afford the food that you'd like, to skipping meals and experiencing hunger. And what we know is that now 13.5% of Australian households experience this in a given year. And this data was released by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It's the first time they've measured food security in more than a decade. And this is a really big problem. I don't think many people would think about food insecurity occurring in Australia. We often think, well, there's lots of food available, surely people can access it. But what we know is that people are struggling with the rising cost of living in terms of their housing and their energy bills. And what that means is when people don't have enough money, they know they can always cut back a little bit more on their grocery shop, they can buy some cheaper or less healthy food, or they can go and seek emergency food relief from somewhere like Food Bank. But this is not food security, and I think it's a really big problem in Australia.
What kind of nutrients are people missing out on when they can't afford enough food?
For nutrition, food insecurity is a really big problem. We know based on research in the Australian context that fruits and vegetables are the first thing to come off people's grocery list when they're worried about not having enough money for food. It's probably because those are products that can spoil and don't have a long shelf life. And we know people tend to buy more energy-dense, shelf-stable products when they're worried about not having enough. If somebody's experiencing severe food insecurity, where they're skipping meals and experiencing hunger, they're having a much poorer quality diet than those who are food secure. And that can lead to a much higher risk of chronic diseases like diabetes and cardiovascular disease. But not only that, we know food insecurity is associated with poorer mental health. So when you're worried about not having enough money for food, of course, that's going to cause you a lot of stress. And food insecurity is associated with a much higher proportion of mental health issues and social isolation, which is a really big problem currently going on in Australia.
What are the most, I guess, effective ways to make healthy food more affordable for families currently doing it tough?
So if we have anyone listening who is doing it tough, we know that there are things that exist within the community to help people access more food. We know that emergency food relief exists. That's where people go and seek free food from a charity, but that is not always a solution for every family. There are other things like food cooperatives where they're popping up all across different communities and they exist through things like Box Divi. That's where members join a hub and they buy food in bulk, often directly from farmers, which saves money. There are also other community-based approaches like social supermarkets. And if any of the listeners are down in Victoria, that's like shops like the Community Grocer that sell donated or surplus food at much lower costs, and it helps people to buy cheaper food. But what I really want to stress is that we should not be accepting this in the Australian context. We should not be okay with the fact that one in eight households can't afford enough food. So we need to be calling on the government to step in and help create policies that make buying food easier for Australians. The first thing would be to strengthen income support. We need governments to raise the amount of job seeker or other government payments, because that would mean that people have more money in their budgets to cover food alongside their rent. We know there are other countries offering free meals to children, like through school lunch programs. And we think that's an important opportunity for the Australian government to invest in, to ensure that kids are not going hungry every day.
That was Senior Lecturer in Nutrition and Dietetics from the University of Wollongong, Dr. Catherine Kent, speaking to The Wire. A migrant settlement organisation has released its fifth research on refugee settlement and integration. The latest research commissioned by Settlement Services International focuses on refugees with a disability and the challenges they face when arriving in Australia. The report also recommends reviewing the settlement policy to ensure it aligns with disability strategy, so the process is streamlined. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked Head of Research and Policy at SSI, Dr. Tiger McMahone, what the research entails.
This research data developed about 5 years ago. We were interested in, we're an organisation that helps to settle newly arrived refugees. And so we were interested in the social connections and the rights and responsibilities of those refugees. Because a lot of the research that has, in the past research, tends to focus more on their health, their employment, their education and training. All of those things are important. But at SSI, we felt that social connections and access to rights and responsibilities are really important parts of living a new life or starting a new life in a new country.
And what are some of the specific support services refugees with a disability need to thrive in Australia?
Well, we're lucky in many respects in Australia. We're a wealthy country and we have excellent settlement services in Australia. And we also have very good disability services in Australia. We have not just the NDIS, but also a range of health and other modalities of support. I guess the issues are that the refugees with disabilities need the same types of services and supports that other people with disabilities need. They also need the same types of services and supports that other refugees need. The issue becomes that intersection is where things don't necessarily work, because of course refugees with disabilities are both refugees, but they're also living with a disability.
And we usually don't hear about refugees with disabilities, so I think this is a very important aspect of the research to be considered.
It is very rare for research to be conducted, and that's partly because it's actually quite hard to do, not just here in Australia, but also internationally. So one of the things that we wanted to do, because we're an organisation that not only do we provide support to refugees, we also provide support to people to access the NDIS. And so we're in a unique position, really, in many respects, in that we both see refugees with disabilities as refugees in one part of our program support areas, but we also see them as people with disabilities in another part of our program areas.
Now, how misaligned is the link between being a refugee and disability policies according to the research?
According to the research, really, we do need to lift our game. We have excellent settlement policies and excellent settlement programs, and we also have quite world-leading disability policies and disability programs. But again, going back to that, it's actually how do we get those two things to actually match up so that settlement policies are responsive to refugees with disabilities and so that disability policy is responsive to refugees. So it's trying to get those two, I suppose, silos in a sense, if you want to call them that, to work better so that refugees with disabilities who are living that life that intersects between those two silos are able to live their life to their full potential.
And one of the interesting things the report shows is that refugees with a disability struggle to access government services. Why is this?
Look, I think they share the difficulties that many refugees face in accessing services, and they also share the difficulties that people with disabilities have in terms of accessing government services. But our research found that language difficulties was the highest barrier that our participants nominated themselves, followed by things like difficulties in using and finding mobile apps for the services they need. So MyGov, Medicare, those kind of apps that we all need to survive in the world. Waiting for appointments, because if you're a person with disability, you're often waiting a long time for specialist appointments. Things like transport difficulties. So these are the kind of, and then of course, not knowing where to go to get help.
Now, what is Settlement Services International recommending in this report to the federal government to improve services to refugees with a disability?
Look, I think the first thing I would say, Eduardo, is that we have recommendations for the federal government, but we also have recommendations for all governments and for organizations like ourselves, Settlement Services. So we don't believe that one place is going to actually fix this issue, fix these issues. And so for the Australian government, for the federal government, we do think that we need to see increased resourcing for on-arrival settlement services. We also need to maintain the specialised services that we have in settlement services. For other Australian governments, there's a lot of redesign happening or a lot of reform happening at the moment in disability. And we think that all Australian governments, state and territory and federal governments, need to be rethinking about refugees with disabilities.
That was Dr. Tiger McMahon from the Settlement Services International there, speaking with the Wise Eduardo Jordan. For the full interview, you can listen to Fair Comment on the Community Radio Network. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakir, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.